London police chief resigns after a string of racism and sexism scandals rocks the British capital's police force. Inflation in the U.S. climbs its highest level in 40 years in January, with prices rising by a record 7.5% from a year ago. And thousands of Sudanese returned to the streets in their latest mass rally, protesting against last year's military coup. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, London Police Chief Cressida Dick has resigned. Mayor Sadiq Khan says that he has accepted the resignation as he was unsatisfied with her job.
Last week I made clear to the Metropolitan Police Commissioner the scale of the change I believe is urgently required to rebuild the trust and confidence of Londoners in the Met and to root out the racism, sexism, homophobia, bullying, discrimination and misogyny that still exists. I am not satisfied with the Commissioner's response. On being informed of this, Dame Cressida Dick has offered her resignation, which I have accepted.
Khan says it's clear only way to start change in London's Metropolitan Police Department requires new leadership. Cressida Dick says she was left with no choice after Khan made it clear to her that he had lost confidence in her leadership. Met has been shaken in recent years by revelations, including abductions, rape, and murder of a woman by one of its officers. A culture of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny has also rocked the police force. Journalist and commentator James Tweedy says Metropolitan Police have been facing a lot of criticism recently, and Mayor Khan had no choice but to replace the police chief.
There is a general feeling about that at the moment. There's been a whole series of scandals just recently. There have been two arrests of police officers in the force for rape since the Sarah Everard case. There has been a couple of incidents where police were caught sending inappropriate messages to each other, joking about murder victims. So, yeah, I don't think she's popular. I don't think anyone will miss her. She'd just been attacked from the left just recently for launching a very strange a police investigation into these alleged parties at Downing Street during the lockdown. This is an offence which is the police do not retrospectively investigate in normal circumstances. And by launching this investigation, she has delayed the official report into it that was being conducted by a civil servant. And people are saying that was her acting to save Boris Johnson. But like I say, it's ironic because she was appointed by a mayor from the Labour Party.
George Ibrahim Abdullah, Europe's oldest political prisoner, has once again been denied freedom by French courts. Many say the pro-Palestinian fighter has effectively been handed a death term, but Abdullah's supporters say they will never stop demanding his liberation. Rami Mazahiri reports.
France has totally rejected a legal request for the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner, George Ibrahim Abdullah, who is known as the Arab Nelson Mandela. In 1902, Israel had invaded Lebanon yet again. Abdullah's resistance group accepted responsibility for the deaths of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris, saying they were the legitimate acts of self-defense of a country under foreign invasion. Abdullah's trial was noted for its lack of proof, and his own lawyer later confessed to secretly working for the government. Ultimately, it seems that France has inaccurately classified Abdullah not as a soldier, but as a common criminal. There have been favorable court decisions for Abdullah over the decades, but governmental interference has not allowed them to be implemented or respected. If France refuses to let their courts release Abdullah, then it seems they are intent on forcing him to die in jail, and in a country which prides itself on having abolished the death penalty a few decades ago. Abdullah refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and many believe that's a primary reason why he hasn't been released.
George is a fighter. He'll have no problem with this latest injustice. After 37 years of harassment, bullying, and humiliation, he is well aware that the deck is stacked against him. George maintains a vast global correspondence despite his imprisonment, and he still lives for the movement of anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics.
The fight for the liberation of George Abdullah has gone from total obscurity to becoming an international cause, with anti-French protests recently held in North Africa, Lebanon, and even Latin America. Demonstrators say that they and Abdullah's supporters worldwide will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Inflation in the United States has been driven higher, hammering American consumers. The Federal Reserve is expected to increase interest rates to try to batter the inflation. To put this into perspective, we discussed the U.S. economy earlier in our news review program. Here it is. Now, Wall Street has ended sharply lower after an official data showed U.S. inflation soared to new four-decade high in January. Data from the U.S. Labor Department shows consumer prices surged 7.5% last month. That's the biggest, higher-than-expected annual increase in inflation since 1982. Broad increase in prices was led by soaring costs for rents, electricity, and food. The Federal Reserve will probably move to cool down the economy by raising interest rates, as inflation could imperil President Joe Biden's economic agenda. Official data comes as the U.S. economy is still recovering from the pandemic shock. Supply shortages and snags in global supply chains are principal causes behind rising inflation and consumer prices. Joining us now for the program is Jack Rasmus, professor of political economy from St. Mary's College in San Francisco, California, and Mr. Mike Harris, finance editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in overcast San Francisco, California, with you, Professor Rasmus. Hope you're safe and doing well. Help us understand what's going on with the U.S. economy.
Well, you know, the numbers came out for a consumer price index today, 7.5%. Actually, it's probably around 10% for reasons I'm not going to get into here. But whether it's 7.5% or 10%, you know, it's a pretty significant consumer price inflation going on. Mainstream media says, oh, it's a demand. Too much money was provided in the spring. Actually, that's not true. There's only a couple hundred billion hit the economy in the third quarter when inflation took off out of a $5 trillion economy. So it couldn't be demand. It is, to some extent, supply chains, global supply chains. But that doesn't explain it all either because, you know, look, most of the goods that are imported to the U.S. Are manufactured goods, some agricultural goods. And you know, that's only 12% of the economy, manufacturing in total, so we're only got maybe 2 or 3% of supply chain manufactured goods contributing to inflation. What you got in my opinion is that you've got monopolistic corporations. In other words, maybe three or four of them controlling a whole industry. Oil is and energy is a good example. Utilities, electricity, they are pure monopolies. You've got meat cutting, you know, maybe four or five, cereal production, maybe four or five, oil companies, you know, only a few of those really run the show here in the United States. And none of those industries in which we see the inflation contributing significantly, oil prices have almost doubled, none of them suffering from supply problems or a significant change in demand. So it's not supply and demand. What it is that these companies that aren't really constrained by supply or demand are price gouging. They're raising their prices because they can, and they're hiding behind the narrative of supply chain problems and demand problems. You know, Republicans say it's demand because they don't want to spend anymore, and Democrats say, oh, it's supply, you know, it's the foreigners, it's not us. They're both passing the buck. And they're both ignoring the fact that we've got price gouging going on, and it's going to go on for some time because it's part of the expectations now. Even the Federal Reserve District President in San Francisco yesterday admitted that, oh, this isn't going to end very soon. It'll end eventually. Well, you know, if it ends eventually, this kind of inflation has always been associated with a recession that followed it. So that's quite possible what we're looking at in 2023 or 24.
Thank you, Professor. Mr. Mike Harris, welcome to the program, sir. Thanks for your patience. Now,
thank you.
Mr. Harris, I mean, it's really a tough time for a lot of Americans. My mother is one of them. How much more can they take?
Well, not much more, but I agree with what the earlier guest said. The professor is correct that there are too much control of too many assets by too few people. We have a concentration of wealth in this country that needs to be upset. But there's a more fundamental problem, and that began back in the Reagan administration when they began deficit spending and borrowing. Now we have the government itself is borrowing so much money, less than 40% of the revenues of the government are actually generated by taxes. The rest is from borrowing. And so if they raise these interest rates, the biggest expense that the government's going to have in all of their expenditures is going to be interest itself. And so this is going to have a very, very chilling effect on the economy. And I expect the housing bubble to pop, the stock market bubble to pop. All of these things are going to pop as interest rates go up. And I think that the people in the U.S. are in for some real deflationary problems once these issues manifest themselves. And we're really looking at a very, very tough time here. We don't have a manufacturing base left in the country. We don't really have a means of wealth creation that manufacturing provided us. That was under Bill Clinton when he signed NAFTA, GATT, let China in the WTO. And we haven't really stopped that trend yet. It's not going to stop until we bring manufacturing back into our country and start creating value in things and not borrowing every cent we have. Like I said, the service economy is a good thing as far as it goes, but wealth creation starts whenever you make products, and the U.S. has given that up, and that needs to come back and come home. And if you do that, your economic foundation will begin to restore itself, but that's going to be a long, painful process. And I'm looking at some real steep declines in real estate and in the stock market, where people are going to be crushed and going to lose a great deal of their wealth on paper anyway.
Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. We're out of time. Thank you, and stay safe. Mr. Mike Harris from Phoenix, Arizona, and Professor Jack Rasmus joining us from San Francisco, California. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Judges and lawyers stage a rally in the Tunisian capital to vent anger at the dissolution of a key judicial watchdog by President Kais Saied. And more than 200 people gathered outside of the main court in Tunis to denounce the decision. After dissolving the Supreme Judicial Council, Saied said on Sunday that he'll issue a decree effectively scrapping the body and changing it with the new council. Protesters say the council is the only independent judicial institution in the country and called Saied's decision a violation of human rights. Council was one of the last remaining institutions in the country able to work independently of the president. And thousands of Sudanese have once again taken to the streets to protest against last year's military coup, which upended a transition to civilian rule. Crowds wave flags and chanted slogans in the capital Khartoum and the twin city of Omdurman. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse demonstrators. No casualties were reported, but Sudan has been witnessing regular protests since the October coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The military takeover then derailed a power-sharing arrangement between army and civilian leaders following the 2019 ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Nearly 80 people have been killed and hundreds injured since then. People are also calling for justice for those killed in the military crackdown. Abiyomi Ezekiwe is editor of Pan-African Newswire. He joined us earlier to give us some perspective on the months-long protests against Sudan's military rulers.
The demonstrations are continuing. This has been going on for months. There are multiple demonstrations every week coming up on the 14th, this coming Monday. There's another general strike and mass demonstrations that are planned because the military is refusing to relinquish power. They have no faith, meaning the mass democratic movement in Sudan, in the military's capacity or ability or willingness to reform themselves. And the fact that they're being supported by external elements, for example, Hamedi, who is the head of the militias in Sudan, is visiting the United Arab Emirates because they are funding the Sudanese military to keep them in power. Also reports that a high-ranking official from Sudan, military official, is visiting Tel Aviv right now, which is supporting the military and is in opposition to the mass democratic movement. So they are taking on not only the domestic clients of these foreign interests, but the actual interests themselves that are backed by the United States.
Now, the Yemeni army says it has successfully targeted Abha Airport in Saudi Arabia's region of Asir. Army spokesperson Yahya Sari said the Qasif K2 drones were used in the operation, which has reportedly disrupted flights out of the airport. Sari noted that Saudi-led coalition has been using the airport to launch airstrikes against Yemen. Coalition warplanes have bombed different parts of the country, including the capital Sana'a, in recent days. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched war against Yemen in early 2015. The U.S. has been assisting the coalition with munitions and intelligence. The war has brought about a severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen, pushing millions of people to the verge of starvation. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
خاکتو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمنم من نمن منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
Since 1979, pro-resistance groups in the world's most militarized region have used Iran's Islamic Revolution as a powerful mechanism to mobilize masses against forces that perpetuate various forms of injustice and snatch people's fundamental rights. We have prepared for you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The article is titled, How Iran's Islamic Revolution Gained Foothold in Kashmir.
So
soon after the pro-West puppet regime in Iran was toppled through a popular socio-political movement in 1979, the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, famously declared that the revolution will challenge and decimate arrogant powers across the world. The path-breaking idea was incorporated in the country's constitution, affirming Iran's support for the just struggles of the oppressed people against the oppressors, which later paved the way for a revolutionary movement that took the Muslim world by storm, including in the Indian subcontinent. So what began as a popular nationwide uprising against the hideous plot to westernize Iran transformed into a global movement against despotism, tyranny and hegemonic schemes of the world's arrogant powers. Nations took inspiration from Imam Khomeini's spirited, unwavering resistance to free his country from the clutches of foreign powers who remotely controlled their local minions. Over the past four decades, the movement has gripped the hearts and minds of people everywhere. To invoke the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the Islamic Revolution is akin to the scent of spring flowers carried by breeze to different corners of the world. In Kashmir, the picturesque Himalayan region, ravaged by decades of conflict, the breezy fragrance feels more strongly 43 years on. The abode of Sufis and saints which embraced Islam in the 14th and 15th century, courtesy of Iranian religious missionaries like Sayyid Sharafuddin Bulbul Shah, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani and Mir Sayyid Shamsuddin Araghi, adopted Imam Khomeini's revolution in letter as well as the spirit. Since 1979, pro-resistance groups in the world's most militarized region have used Iran's Islamic Revolution as a powerful mechanism to mobilize the masses against forces that perpetuate various forms of injustice and snatch people's fundamental rights. The appeal of Imam Khomeini's resistance manual cuts across sectarian lines in the Muslim-majority region, with both Shias and Sunnis crediting him for reinvigorating their struggle for freedom from oppression, subjugation and occupation. Today, the biggest public rallies to mark the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution outside Iran are held in Indian-controlled Kashmir. In places like Srinagar, Budgam, Kargil and more. Around this time of the year, streets in these places are dotted with pictures and banners, paying glowing tribute to Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and his companions. To put things into perspective, Imam Khomeini had a deep and personal affiliation with Kashmir. The unshakable allegiance of Kashmiris to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution has to be seen in the context of the advocacy of their long-standing political struggle by both Imam Khomeini and his worthy successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Way back in 1965, during a speech in Najaf in Iraq, Imam Khomeini had equated Kashmir with Palestine. He called on Muslims across the globe to lay aside their differences and unite in support of causes like Kashmir and occupied Palestine. That was before all hell broke loose in the contested region in the late 1980s. While the situation turned from bad to worse in the 1990s, Iran's support remained steadfast. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, known for his unequivocal statements, has followed his mentor's roadmap on Kashmir. He has often emphasized the just struggle of the people of Palestine and the people of Kashmir in his sermons and speeches. One of his widely reported statements came on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr in 2017, when he spoke of many wounds inflicted on the body of the Muslim world, singling out Bahrain, Yemen, and Kashmir, and urging Muslims to openly support the people of those countries. After the events of August of 2019, the leader of the Islamic Revolution again called on the Indian government to adopt a just policy towards the noble people of Kashmir and prevent the oppression and bullying of Muslims in this region. The statement was widely welcomed and hailed by the people of Kashmir. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei had, in 1980, just a year after the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, visited Kashmir when he delivered a historic lecture at Srinagar's Jame Mosque. He also joined congressional prayers led by then Kashmir's chief priest, Mirwais Muhammad Farooq, and visited the residence of Kashmir's then top Shia leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf Musavi. Imam Khomeini had, through his envoy, conveyed special greetings to Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf Musavi for his indefatigable efforts in championing the cause of the Islamic Revolution and Islamic revival in Kashmir. Their association dated back to the years when Imam Khomeini was in exile in Iraq. They had exchanged a series of letters discussing important issues through Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf's son, Sayyid Fazlullah Musavi, who was a student in Najaf in Iraq. In one of the letters, Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf Musavi invited Imam Khomeini to Kashmir, assuring him safety and protection there. According to an account mentioned in the book, Tajalliyat by Allama Sayyid Baghir Musavi, during his time in Paris, France, when Imam was asked by a French journalist where he would prefer to go if his asylum was revoked by the French government, his answer was Kashmir. It demonstrated his profound love and trust in Kashmiris. After the 1979 revolution, a stream of religious scholars, diplomats, and political dignitaries traveled to Kashmir, most notably Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Ayatollah Reza Mahdavi Kani, and others after them. Their visits cemented the historic ties between Iran and Kashmir, also known as Iran-e-Saghir, and further bolstered support for the Islamic Revolution. Today, people in this Himalayan region draw spiritual as well as resistance leadership from the Islamic Republic of Iran. They celebrate the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution every year with great enthusiasm. They continue to see themselves as loyal soldiers of the Islamic Revolution. As a testament to their love and loyalty for Iran and the Islamic Revolution, today we find town squares in Kashmir named after the leaders of the Islamic Revolution, including Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and Imam Khamenei. We see social and cultural organizations named after the martyrs like Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Beheshti. We see youth emulating top general Qasem Soleimani, Mohsen Hojaji, and Ibrahim Hadi, reading and writing about them. After the January of 2020 assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC's Quds Force, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the second-in-command of Iraq's popular mobilization units, in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad International Airport, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Kashmir. They burned the effigies of then-U.S. President Donald Trump and his minions, and reaffirmed their pledge to the sacrosanct ideals of the Islamic Revolution. The same ideals fueled their discontent and anger at the arrogant powers at home. This is the miracle of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and his illustrious legacy of speaking the truth to power, the legacy that is rooted in history, in the events of Karbala 14 centuries ago.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is IRIB English Radio. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. This is Asma, and from Muslim Ladies Studio, I invite you to our cozy corner where we talk about some important stuff concerning Muslim lady. So, welcome to your own zone, dear ladies. Here with me, I have an amazing guest, Sister Shamali. Thank you for joining us and welcome to today's program.
Thank you very much for having me. Assalamu alaikum to all the brothers and sisters who are listening to our program. An honor to be here.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here with you.
Thank you.
This is the first time I'm meeting you, actually.
Yeah,
shall you please tell me a little bit about the area of your study?
I've been doing research in the field of women and family for the past couple of 10 years, and now I'm a PhD candidate in the field of women's rights in Islam.
Yes. As you know, we are getting close to the anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution, in which women had a remarkable role. We open up this episode in honor of all the great women who watered the tree of Islam with the blood of their men and helped it flourish with their strength and endurance. We already know that there is a striking difference in the conditions of Muslim lady before and after the Islamic Revolution. Things changed, and I think it's pretty safe to say that women got plenty of freedom and independence. Revolution has offered many notable modifications to women's life.
Exactly. One of the things that happened after the Islamic Revolution was that very academic, advanced seminaries started up for women. One of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution was that to give men and women, not only women, but, you know, to give them the facilities.
To universities and facilities, educational facilities.
Exactly. It actually gave men and women, you know, by opening up so many different universities, like you had the governmental universities, you had the Azad universities, the Payam Nur universities, like so many different branches of universities opened up, giving women and men the mm-hmm. possibility to, you know, to take part in different fields. And since men and women were able to take part in the exam, to compete in the entrance exam of these universities, there was no limitations or restrictions for mm-hmm. Women entering different fields. Like there was no...
They had the same rights.
Yeah, exactly. So because of that, they, both of them, the boys and the girls, showed a lot of achievement. And as a matter of fact, up until a couple of years ago, even maybe this year, more than 50% of the candidates who got accepted in university were women.
Yes.
So that shows that...
That's a tremendous number.
In different fields like chemistry, biology, physics, mining, agriculture, men and women had 100% complete chances to mm-hmm. take part in these fields. And then the thing is that some people, some critics are against the idea.
The
idea of giving women exactly complete equality in the different majors that mm-hmm. exist in university. I mean, they say that if you believe that in the Islamic government and in the system of family, there should be different role assigned to men and women, mm-hmm. then wasting so much money and energy and deviating the attention of women to fields that would not necessarily benefit them in the future, this is a waste of money and time and human resources.
And we need a woman to take the initiative. But, you know, sometimes, I don't know, like, for example, you see in medical study, the women are doing a great job.
No, medical field is a very different field. You actually need women to study in medical field because you need to have female doctors, nurses.
Okay, let's say in a place where the majority of the inhabitants are women.
Okay.
For example, maybe for some special cases, women are needed in mining, agriculture. Actually, I don't believe in that. In agriculture, women are more important than men.
How?
How? Because many fields are running by women. They are doing the different roles as the person who is taking the responsibility of the field. We are talking about women's expectation after the revolution, and this is Muslim Lady. It's time to go for a break.
Millions of Iranians across the country have begun 10 days of celebrations marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that put an end to the monarchy of the Pahlavi regime in Iran.
Okay, in a glimpse of an eye, we're back. Welcome to your Muslim Lady. This is a new session that we're talking about the expectations of women after the revolution. And here with me, I have my dear guest, Miss Shameli. We talked about the expectations of women after revolution. Now we are resuming that discussion. What are the expectations of women that came true after the revolution? We talked, we said that educational system changed. They had many changes. Even they are going for majors that are not pretty much designed for women, but they have the right to go for it. Mm-hmm. They have the chance to go for it. Do you want to add anything more to those?
I think one of the most important expectation that women could have from a government or from an Islamic government is to allow them to have a secure life, to have the feeling of security in terms of their marriage, economics.
Oh, to give them insurance.
Yeah, yeah.
Guarantee them.
Yeah, then there's this question of how.
How, yes.
And then their economic position, their jobs, health facilities.
Exactly.
Parks. You know, entertainment, that places for entertainment where women would be able to physically attend without any worries and, you know, to have fun and to, you know, to enjoy. And some of these have been realized in the Islamic government, right?
Yes, I would say most of them.
Yeah, most of them. For instance, well, some people are actually against the idea of having parks that are only for women. And they're like, you know, what kind of, what are you thinking that you separate men and women in parks and then you say this park specifically for women? But then in an Islamic government, in an Islamic society where the hijab is mandatory and people are, you know, they have to observe the hijab. So it's very good to give women a corner that they would be able to remove their hijabs.
Exactly. They would have freedom.
Yeah.
This is exactly what freedom is going to talk about women. Having some special entertaining places for women that is specialized for them is giving them the freedom they need to have.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
We as women have experienced that. It's pretty much easier for you to be in an environment in which you see all women. You have perhaps the same interests. And you do not worry about anything that might happen in the way.
Actually, we have some of these parks. For example, in our own city, there is one specific park that is specifically for women.
Yes, and that is very big.
Yeah, it's very big. And they can, you know... do cycling. There's a trampoline. There are like different sports facilities.
All sorts of entertainment. They come there and gather together and have parties.
Yeah, exactly.
Together. So that's pretty much a freedom.
It is. It is.
The space they need to have in their society.
Yeah, that's very good. So that is one of the things that we have. Just the feeling of security. That is the most important thing.
Let's go for a little break and then we'll be back. Thank you for listening to us and giving your ears and attention. We'll be back. Don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
One of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution that I have witnessed with my own eyes, and I have experienced it, and I'm so happy about it, is the fact that we are, even at night, it's 10, 11, 12 at night.
That was exactly the thing I was going to say.
Uh-huh.
You can travel even between the cities.
Yeah.
Late at night with no worries.
Exactly.
That's a very good point you mentioned.
Yeah. The fact that in other countries, after sunset, you don't really feel safe to go out of your home. Because I remember my own childhood that after sunset, they would tell us, don't go outside. It's not safe for women to go outside. But here, even when it's 11 or 12 at night, I sometimes come back from, you know, shopping or going out. And I feel so secure. There is no fear of, you know, being molested or being
bullied.
Yeah. So this is one more thing that women expect. And alhamdulillah, in the Islamic Revolution of Iran, they have achieved that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that, as we said in the beginning of our program, women were given equal chances for education, and as a result, you have many women specialists, many women doctors. And for example, when you want to refer to a gynecologist and you feel that you're not comfortable with a man, a woman doctor is available for you. And this is something that, like in other countries, when you go to see a gynecologist, you're a Muslim woman. And they choose a male doctor for you, and you're like, what? You know, that doesn't work. But here, like, everybody takes it for granted that the doctor has to be a female figure, right? So that you would be comfortable with. So this is a blessing that sometimes, you know, being so submerged in this blessing, so delved into this blessing, we don't even realize that we have
such things.
We take
it for granted.
Exactly. Yeah, so this is one of the other achievements, one of the other expectations that women had and has been achieved in the Islamic
Revolution. Exactly. And plenty more, of course.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, mothers, sisters, wives and daughters, ladies of any kind, thanks for giving us your ears and attention. The whole cast of Muslim Lady and I wish you health and happiness. Until another episode of Muslim Lady, stay tuned. Take care until another session. May Allah protect you.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, MPs from all sides angrily rounded on Boris Johnson and accused him of whipping up political poison after the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, was set upon by protesters who accused him of protecting the late television presenter and paedophile, Jimmy Savile. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Jessica Elgott and Rowena Mason. The piece is titled, MPs Blame Boris Johnson's Poison After Protesters Mob Keir Starmer. MPs from all sides angrily rounded on Prime Minister Boris Johnson and accused him of whipping up political poison after the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, was set upon by protesters who accused him of protecting the late television presenter and paedophile Jimmy Savile. Boris Johnson provoked widespread fury last week when he suggested that Keir Starmer had protected Jimmy Savile during his time as Director of Public Prosecutions. The comments drew criticism from two former Tory chief whips and prompted the resignation of a long-serving aide to Prime Minister Johnson. On Monday, 7th of February, Keir Starmer and the Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy had to be bundled into a police car after anti-vax protesters surrounded him near Parliament with shouts of "traitor" and "Jimmy Savile." One witness said a protester carried a hangman's noose prop, which another protester had joked was for Starmer. Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy said it was no surprise the conspiracy theorist thugs who harassed Keir Starmer and I repeated slurs we heard from Boris Johnson last week at the dispatch box. Intimidation, harassment and lies have no place in our democracy, and they won't ever stop me doing my job. The former Chief Whip Julian Smith was among at least seven Conservative MPs to criticise Boris Johnson as he described the events as appalling. It is really important for our democracy and for our security that the false Jimmy Savile slurs made against him are withdrawn in full, Julian Smith tweeted. Calls for an apology also came from Sir Roger Gale, Anthony Mangnall and Tobias Elwood, Tory MPs who have sent letters of no confidence in Boris Johnson, as well as Stephen Hammond, who has expressed significant concerns about the Prime Minister. Conservative MP Rob Largan also said it was time to defuse the situation. Words matter. What we say and how we say it echoes out far beyond Parliament. It can have serious real-world consequences. Elected representatives have a responsibility to lower the temperature of debate, not add fuel to the fire. Boris Johnson said the behaviour directed at the Leader of the Opposition tonight is absolutely disgraceful, but stopped short of apologising for his earlier remarks. All forms of harassment of our elected representatives are completely unacceptable. Boris Johnson added, I thank the police for responding swiftly. Labour sources were furious at the incident, though Keir Starmer was unharmed and escorted back to his office within minutes. Boris Johnson and his cabinet chose to lie down with the dogs, and now the whole lot of them are covered in fleas, one Labour source said. The row over Boris Johnson's Jimmy Savile comments has been cited by a number of Tory MPs who have submitted letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister, 54 of which must be sent to trigger a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson. During an exchange in the House of Commons last Monday, 31st of January, Boris Johnson said Keir Starmer was a former director of public prosecutions who spent more time prosecuting journalists and failing to prosecute Jimmy Savile. Keir Starmer did not take the decision personally, but had apologised for institutional failings after Jimmy Savile's abuse was revealed. Munira Mirza, one of Boris Johnson's closest aides who headed the No. 10 policy unit, quit last Thursday after urging Johnson to retract his earlier comments. Cabinet ministers have also expressed unease at the remarks, including the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, during a national press conference, saying, I wouldn't have said it. Other cabinet ministers have defended the remarks, including the business secretary Kwasi Kwarteng and the justice secretary Dominic Raab, who called it part of the cut and thrust of politics. The incident on Monday night, 7th of February, prompted renewed anger from MPs. Labour's Chris Bryant tweeted that Boris Johnson's comments were directly responsible for circulating links between Keir Starmer and Jimmy Savile, which had originally appeared in far-right websites. This is appalling. People were shouting all sorts at Keir, including Jimmy Savile. This is what happens when a prime minister descends into the gutter and recycles lies from hard-right conspiracy theorists. Political poison has an effect. Boris Johnson has no moral compass, he wrote. The shadow minister, Yasmin Qureshi, said, the Prime Minister enabled and actively encouraged this. Liam Byrne, the MP and former mayoral candidate, said, "The best of this country will always defeat the worst. But now we see clearly the kind of behaviour that Boris Johnson is prepared to incite." The Labour Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, also blamed Boris Johnson for amplifying the false claims. "This is what happens when fake news is amplified and given credibility by people who should know better. Solidarity with Keir Starmer and David Lammy. Thank you to the Metropolitan Police officers for their swift intervention." The Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, had earlier said it was time to move on from the row over Boris Johnson's Jimmy Savile comments. "I think we should draw a line under this issue and try to move on, because the Prime Minister has come forward and clarified his remarks." Boris Johnson is expected to reshuffle his team on Tuesday, including a shake-up of the Whip's office that could see the Chief, Mark Spencer, sacked. Chris Pincher, a housing minister and ally of the Prime Minister, is tipped to replace him. The Prime Minister will also continue the overhaul of his back office team after recruiting Steve Barclay, the Cabinet Office Minister, as his Chief of Staff, and Gotto Hari, his former spokesperson, as his new Director of Communications. Henry Newman, the Deputy Chief of Staff and an ally of Carrie Johnson, is also leaving Number 10 to return to a job in Michael Gove's team. Steve Barclay addressed Number 10 staff on Monday, saying he wanted to create a mutually supportive environment after difficult recent weeks, and assuring them his doors is always open. He will now divide his time between Number 10 and the Cabinet Office, with some of his portfolio distributed to other ministers. Gotto Hari was also present at the staff meeting after drawing criticism from Labour Party over his previous job for a lobbying firm and a media interview in which he recounted Boris Johnson appearing to make light of his troubles by singing "I Will Survive." Labour called for more scrutiny of Gotto Hari's past work for the lobbying firm, saying, "We can have the revolving door from lobbying to government see potential national security issues arise." The Labour Party called for more scrutiny of Gotto Hari's past work for the lobbying firm, saying, "We can't have the revolving door from lobbying to government see potential national security issues arise. We need full transparency from Gotto Hari about all contact he had with government in his former role as a lobbyist and who his clients were." Scotland Yard said two arrests were made following clashes between police and protesters on the Victoria Embankment in London after Keir Starmer was taken to safety. A Metropolitan Police statement said shortly after 5:10 p.m. on Monday, 7th of February, a man who had been surrounded by a group of protesters near to New Scotland Yard was taken away from the scene by a police car. A man and a woman were arrested at the scene for assault on an emergency worker after a traffic cone was thrown at a police officer. They have been taken into custody.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.